The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Thank you all for being here today. Dan and I are very honored to be with you on this beautiful Sunday afternoon. Dan, I'm sure a lot of people in the audience know who Sam is, but tell us about your grandson, Sam.
He's the Buddha.
Okay.
Only with a far better sense of humor than... who is he? He is... If you haven't seen pictures, I'll show them to you afterwards. He's gorgeous. He's got a wonderful personality. He is and always has been filled with love. And I think one of the things that makes him remarkable is all infants, toddlers, up to age 3, 4, all of them are filled with love and compassion and the ability to experience life moment to moment. Sam's 10 years old and still has those qualities. Now, I pray they never go away. He has become my playmate, always was. Of course, my grandson, and in many respects, he is a teacher in the same way that people call me a teacher. You know, I at the end of my speeches, at the end of my books, you know, people compliment me on, you know, my insights. And I say to them, is there anything in there that you didn't already know? And they say, no, but I needed a reminder. And that's what Sam is for me. He's exactly that for me.
Now, I remember when Sam was born and you were a very happy and gushing grandfather, as you still are. And then I remember a while later you came into work and you were very worried and you said, I'm very concerned about Sam. He is not babbling anymore. And you can clap your hands behind him, you can drop pots behind him, and he won't turn his head. We're really concerned. So talk about that phase and then ultimately what came of that.
Well, I'll back up a little bit. You know, you were kind and said I was a gushing grandfather when he was born. I was probably obnoxious, too.
But you get away with it.
You wouldn't say that with a microphone on. So that was the beginning of letters to Sam, because at the time of his birth, I was 53, and I had just come off, I think, MRSA that time. Mm-hmm. And we didn't know if I was going to make it. And by the time he was born, I had regained my health. But I didn't know if he was going to get to know his pop. You know, he'd get to know my writings, and he'd get to, you know, hear the radio show, but he wouldn't get to know my heart, you know. So I started writing these letters about who I was and what it meant to be human through my eyes. But then when he was 18 months old, that happened. And I knew, I knew he was on the autism spectrum. That's when the letters became more urgent, more important, you know, because I knew things he was going to need to know about being different, about living life when people looked at you differently or didn't look at you at all. So that's when it turned into a book, and I wanted to teach him about life, about love, about loss, about alienation, And, you know, that turned into a book. But everything changed right when he stopped babbling. And, you know, my heart broke, not for him, because I had a feeling he'd be okay. That he, I know about living with adversity. You know, the heart heals. You know, the ego fights and kicks and screams, but the heart heals. I worried about his mother. You know, that's, my heart really broke for Debbie because she'd been living with disability since she was 6 years old. I mean, that's when I became a quadriplegic, and now she was going to have to live with it for the rest of her life.
So at first, you weren't sure what to expect for Sam. He was diagnosed with PPD-NOS, which means pervasive developmental disorder, not otherwise specified, which doesn't really tell you much of anything. So you weren't sure, is he ever going to talk? Will he ever be able to interact? Will he ever know and look me in the eye? So when were some of those fears calmed? When did Sam start talking and show compassion and do all of those things?
Well, this gets to the book. I want to start off with how my relationship with him really started. The first year of his life, he was kind of scared of me. I guess it was the wheelchair. He didn't want to have anything to do with me. Then it was my dad's funeral. I forget how old he was. He was about a year old, maybe a drop older. And it was a graveside funeral, and I was sitting there crying by myself. I mean, there was people next to me. And he saw me crying. He was in his mom's arms. And he insisted on coming onto my lap. He was pulling to come on to my lap. He'd never done that before. And he sat on my lap, and he was quiet as I cried. It was like he knew I needed care. So that's Sam, and that was in him. So when he stopped babbling, when he was diagnosed on the autism spectrum, I mean, my heart broke. I worried if that tiny, loving, compassionate voice would ever be heard again. Story goes, about a year after he started speaking, he was 4 years old now, his mother had back surgery, and she was laid up for a long time. She was in a great deal of pain and couldn't get around very well. And I drove down to visit with her. They live in Maryland. And this was the first day she was allowed out to be driven. She was on a walker. So we thought we'd surprise Sam. I'd pick him up at school, and Mom would be in the back of the van. Debbie couldn't get out of the van, but she was sitting in the back, and I went and got Sam, and he came out, and Mom was in the van, and he was happy to see her. And we were driving home, and he turned. Now, he hadn't been speaking long. He turned to his mother, just there was silence in the back of the van, and he turned to his mother, and he said, "How are you back today, Mommy?" And I cried, because that was the compassion, that was the care, that was the selflessness that I felt when he sat on my lap 3 years earlier. So, and that was one of the chapters in Wisdom of Sam, is called "How You Back Today, Mommy."
How did you get, or when did you start thinking of Sam as your teacher, or as a teacher who could say wise things?
Well, it might. Well, I was going to say it was there. I don't know, Mike, and it's some of the things. Maybe it was when he had that meltdown that I wrote about. I don't know how old he was. I don't recall. Maybe 5. And he was still having meltdowns that kids on the autism spectrum do when they get overstimulated in whatever way, visually, tactile, if any of their senses get overstimulated. They'll have meltdowns, and these kids can, you know, bang their heads and harm themselves. Sam was about 5 and had been in therapy since he was 18 months old. So he would still have meltdowns, not as often and not as violent. So here's one day. I mean, we just saw it building over the course of the day. And finally, it happened. And his body got rigid, face got red, filled with rage and anger. And he just screamed for everybody to leave the room, except his mommy and me. And finally, he just collapsed in his mother's arms and sobbed. And he sobbed for a long time. And after it was done, when he reconstituted, he looked at his mommy and he said, "Mommy, everything went too fast inside my head today." And I thought, my God, how many of us could say that? I could have said it that very day. I could say it most days. The difference between Sam and most of us is that he knows it and we don't. And he feels the pain of that racing mind. He feels it and we don't. And I don't know who's better off. I'm inclined to think he is, because he can feel what hurts, and we can't. So that's when I realized that he was the Buddha.
A little one.
A little one.
So one of the things Sam had trouble with was being away from his mother, because your daughter, Debbie, was such a big presence in his life, was always there for Sam, worked with Sam, did everything for Sam. So there was one point in your book where Sam goes on his first overnight stay. So talk about that experience for Sam and for Debbie and the parallels you drew in the book to an episode from your life.
Sam, in addition to being extremely protected by Debbie, by dint of being on the autism spectrum, has a great deal of anxiety. So here's an opportunity for his first overnight away from his mother, and it was something he loved. He was going to go down the shore with Mr. Pete, a guy he loved, and his dad. He was really scared, and he did it. He finally decided to do it, to let go, you know, and to have faith. I talked in the book about in the Bible, in the Old Testament, where the story really begins, is when God says to Abraham, "Lech Lecha" in Hebrew. And you know, the translation traditionally is "leave your father's home," but a rabbi friend of mine said the literal translation is leave what is familiar to you. And that's really the only way we can grow, is to leave what's familiar. I talked about how I had to do that. I mean, most of my growth has come from leaving what's familiar completely involuntarily, you know, with my accident and the loss of my sister and so on and so forth. But what I was struggling with then, when I was writing the book, was leaving the Inquirer, giving up my column. And you know how obsessed I was with that. I was, I was annoying, right? I was... and whoever laughed out there probably knows I was annoying. But I was really obsessed because what would it mean? I mean, the logical brain says, you know, it's my voice in the community and you know, people benefit from this and I get to speak what's in my heart and mind, but it was really a battle between my ego and my soul, like all of these things are. You know, the ego was saying, well, what's this mean? Who will you be without this? What will you be? Is this the beginning of the end for you? And all those questions are questions of the ego, and they're worthless. They're meaningless. They feel so important, but they're not. Ask Sam. The important questions are the one of my soul. What now? What should we open up to? You know, let go of what's familiar and see what happens. So that's what I did. It was painful and it was scary. Don't ask the follow-up question. Don't ask it. Don't ask it.
Okay.
Don't.
I was just going to ask how Sam did on his overnight.
Oh, phew.
Or talk about when he came home. He did fine. I'll summarize.
He did fine on his overnight. And he did better on his overnight than his pop did. He was proud. He experienced the emotion of pride. And the kind of pride that is valuable. You know, parents today tell children they're wonderful for every little thing they do that's meaningless. Or that we tell our children that they're special. They're not.
Only Sam.
Sorry. But here's pride Sam experienced based on something he did. And that's the kind of pride that you're able to hold on to because it helps shift your sense of who you are and what you can do.
I want to talk. Sam started wrestling at some point, and while he's not a great wrestler, he's a very passionate and just involved wrestler, loves to wrestle. So at some point, he asked you to help him with his wrestling because he wasn't winning any matches, and he asked you to toughen him up. So what did you do?
Well, this is one of the chapters in the book, and I started off talking about this was the first time I took a train by myself from 30th Street to Union Station. And I was scared. I mean, I was flat out scared. I mean, you can imagine all the what ifs I went through about parking my van at 30th Street, about tickets, about whether the train was on and on. So I finally get there, and we meet for lunch. And
you meet Sam for lunch, right?
Sam and Debbie for lunch. And I talked to Sam about wrestling. He had just started wrestling, or the year had ended, and he lost all of his matches. So I said, so, Sam, why do you think were the other kids bigger than you? Sam's tiny. So he says, no, we're about the same size. So I said, well, why do you think... you know, you lost. He says, I think the other kids were tougher than me. He said, Pop, you used to wrestle. Could you toughen me up? Well, I didn't tell him that I only wrestled for 1 year, my freshman year in high school, and I quit because I didn't enjoy getting my ass kicked every Saturday morning. It hurt. I have since told him that, and he enjoys it. So he said, will you toughen me up? And I said, sure, having no idea what that meant or what was involved. Well, you know how we toughen our kids up? We let them live their lives. Because toughening kids up is about building resilience, right? And learning that we can get hurt and be okay. You know, there was one time during a wrestling match that Sam got his nose bloody. And his mother was watching. His father's the coach. So his mother was watching, and Debbie saw him crying and blood coming. And she was at the top of the bleachers, and she raced down in this all-male bastion and held Sam in her arms. And everybody looked at her, and she got thrown out of practice. She was banned from practices. And I liked that. I enjoyed that. So, but toughening somebody up is they can learn that they can fall and still get up. And that's how we learn resilience. It's only through adversity that we can learn resilience. And many times we've got to go against our instincts, and our kids can get hurt. That's where they learn about themselves.
So is that what you told Sam? Or did you tell him about your train trip? Or
I did. I told him about my train trip, and I told him how scared I was on that train trip, but how fear is part of us, but that can't be the driver. I mean, we have to be able to drive this ship called our lives. Fear can inform us, but fear can't be the driver. And underneath it all, I knew that I could turn to someone, anyone, and say, please help me. I talked about that in letters to Sam a lot. You know, that real strength is about looking someone in the eye and saying, please help me. So I've learned that after doing that for a long time.
We want to open things up to the audience as well. So if any of you have a question, please raise your hand, and then somebody will come over with a microphone to you.
Question right. Over here.
And we don't have a lot of time, so I'll ask everybody just to keep their questions brief so we can get to a bunch of them. Thank you.
That reminded me of The Karate Kid.
The Karate Kid.
Yes,
yeah.
And Yoda. Yes.
Yeah.
Anyway, what I don't understand, I'm 62. Did they have this when we were young, when I was in school? I don't remember any of these things.
Like what?
Autism, ADD, did the nuns just say, just sit down? And is this a relatively new disease? That's what I'm asking.
You want to tackle that because yeah. You're really up on the research.
Right. I have done a lot of research on autism, and while the diagnosis has skyrocketed, there are many different reasons. Scientists today believe that there is an actual increase in autism, and they believe that there may be some environmental triggers, genetic triggers, or a combination of both. However, they also believe that the way things are diagnosed have changed tremendously. So when you went to school, only the most severe cases were diagnosed, and also children were labeled as, and forgive the language, but that was the language back then, but people were labeled as mentally retarded and ended up in special schools. And all the other kids were just labeled as difficult or couldn't stay in school, couldn't pay attention. So kids just were really not recognized and didn't get the help that they needed as well. So diagnostic tools have gotten a lot better, but scientists are agreeing that there is an actual increase, which is, of course, worrisome. All right, we'll go back there.
Hi. I was wondering if you can give us your impressions of the impact of cell phones and Facebooks and kids always being available on their generation, their development. that kids in school, that they in second grade, they have cell phones.
Funny you should ask. We just did a show on this. Not about kids, but about adults, about our brains, about what technology does to our brains. And it turns out that multitasking, something we all do, the more we do it, the ones who do it the most are the least good at it. And in effect, what it does is it shortens our attention span. It impairs our ability for critical thinking. And it impairs our ability for relationships. And for those of us, I forget the labels these researchers used for relative newcomers to the technology.
Digital natives. Kids today are often called digital natives because they've always had computers. And we are digital immigrants. So we're trying so hard to be on Facebook.
So it's like they told me at WHYY to get on Facebook and Twitter.
Oh, he's on Facebook.
And I did, and I have no idea what it means or what to do. But they do. And so now what's happening is kids are coming out of school and book reading, for example, between ages 20 and 35 is down 40%. These kids aren't reading books because everything is you know, quick cuts on TV or tweets on Twitter. And relationship skills are impaired, and they're more self-absorbed because they can be. But, you know, we can look at it through the eyes of the older generation. But if we could stand back, things are changing. We just don't know how. Our job's to pay attention. And our job, I think, as adults is always, regardless of our age and regardless of the issue, is to be role models. Always. So if you're anything like me, you probably use technology too often also. I'm too dependent on it. We have to be role models for everything, for relationships, for quality of life, for being human, for being involved in the community, for caring for one another. We have to be role models. We can't complain about what they're doing or even what the world is doing. You know, we have to live like Gandhi told us to live, or like any of the great religious leaders told us to live. We've got to be the change we wish to see in the world. We have to change our own behavior.
Question there?
First, I'd like to say thank you for the Voices in the Family show on WHYY. It's, it's one of the reasons why I joined WHYY. I have a son, he's 16. He's been diagnosed as being Asperger's, which, first, the name is just an unfortunate name. My family had a big joke about it, my son the most of all. He's got problems with school. He's fixated on things, and he's between psychiatrists. He goes through psychiatrists like most people go through tissues. Basically, my question is, do I just keep sending him? So we keep sending him and sending him, just trying new things, or do we have to make him stick to one psychiatrist, even though he really has problems dealing with them from time to time?
First of all, you need to send him to someone who specializes in Asperger's. Not every psychiatrist does, and psychiatry isn't necessarily the way to go with Asperger's. In today's world, psychiatry residency emphasizes the brain the biology of psychiatry and medication, and psychotherapy training is secondary. So, and there are no medications for Asperger's. There are medications for symptoms of Asperger's and autism. But, so you need to find someone and a program who specializes in Asperger's. I also want to share with you something I learned from Temple Grandin. For those of you who don't know, Temple Grandin is the superstar of autism. She is to autism what Christopher Reeve was to spinal cord injury, or Michael Fox to Parkinson. So anyway, Debbie and I went to a conference years ago about developing social skills for kids on the autism spectrum. Of course, that's our great fear, you know, that these kids aren't going to have social skills and won't be able to make it. So there's workshops, lectures, and how-tos, and tools and techniques. At the end of the day, Temple Grandin comes up, the one we've been waiting for. And Temple's got autism. I mean, she's high-functioning, but she clearly has autism. And she starts off her talk with a PowerPoint presentation and starts off with a picture of NASA. And she says, now you think this is a space agency where brilliant people come to create new technologies and build new horizons. She says, it's not. She said, it's a federally funded sheltered workshop for people on the autism spectrum. She said, they all have Asperger's in there. She says, if you spend your time, money, and energy trying to fix what's broken, you're going to frustrate them and frustrate yourself. She said, find what works. Find what they do well and have them do it over and over and over again. And they will find their place in the world. They'll feel good about themselves. And I thought that was wise advice. And I thought, you know, where was she when my kids were little? I could have used her then. You know, it's good advice for all of us.
I think we have time for one more question.
Hello. My question is, knowing how important words are, labels, words, the impact they have, it's to you, the news media, when someone takes, say, for instance, a gun, points it at another person and shoots, that person who is holding the gun is a coward. Could we not use that word when we describe them in the news media? I believe if that happens enough times, the people who are doing that will feel bad about themselves because somebody taking a stronger weapon or a person using stronger force against a smaller person is a coward. Couldn't we call them that? Thank you. And why doesn't the new media do that?
Right. Well, because I guess as reporters, we're not supposed to put any value on anything. So we walk a very fine line, and working with language is always difficult, especially working in the field we do, because people are very sensitive to labels. People are very sensitive to language. I understand where you're coming from. True, but also it could be that the person is wrongly accused. So I understand that sometimes there is a frustration because people in the news media walk a very cautious path in terms of language, and sometimes it overly seems so. But on the other hand, we have to do that in many ways because we have to look out for other people's feelings as well.
If we only have a few minutes left, I want to tell a Sam story that didn't make it to that book because this happened after the book was written. I don't know if any of you saw the book trailer. It was just remarkable 2.5-minute piece. Go to YouTube and type Wisdom of Sam. It's just great. Anyway, to film this trailer, we were at a studio in Wilmington, Sam and I, for 4 hours. And we just hung out. Everything we did was taped and photographed, and we had lunch together. We had serious talk. We played pinball together, where he rode around on the back of my wheelchair. But everything was, cameras were following us. At the end of the day, Debbie calls me. She was on her way home. We both were different. And she says, Sam said to me that he had a fun day with Pop, but he said he felt like he lost something private that he and Pop had. So I said to Debbie, I'll call them. We'll cancel the trailer. We'll cancel it. I said, I'll cancel the book. I don't care. It's Sam. It's my relationship. I don't want him to feel like he lost anything in this process. So she said, call him later, and you and Sam have a talk. I called him that evening, and I told him what I told Debbie. And he said, no, Pop. He said, I've been thinking about this, the Buddha. He says, I think what we lost was semi-private. He said, because, you know, it's like if we get famous and, like, we're out on the boardwalk or we're at a restaurant and somebody comes up to us, he says, I won't like that. That won't feel right. He said, but that's semi-private. He said, what's private between us, nobody can ever take away. The wisdom of Sam.
Right. There it is. Thank you all for coming today, and thank you, Dan.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.